Homestead, Pennsylvania is a small suburb out of Pittsburgh, and it's affectionately known as the Rust Belt because the entire economy of the area relied on steel manufacture to sort of sustain itself. And in the 80s, that industry went away, and that's when I was born. So there was no way my parents were going to be able to afford to hook me up with a computer or any cool gadgets or anything like that. I mean, it took probably 15, 16 years for Moore's Law to make it possible for my family to get the computer that I wanted, even though I put it on my Christmas list every year up until that point. What was easily available to me was pencils and paper, and another sort of aspect of the area that I come from is that gang culture started to become very, very popular, and that was a scene that I obviously was not able to fit in with, and there were shootings outside my house all the time. When I was five, I saw the police shoot a guy in the back of my in my backyard. When I was 12, a girl got killed in the alley behind my house. We moved from the first place where I saw the guy get shot. We moved away, and you know, a few blocks away, and somebody got killed in the back of my other house. And then shortly after that, my next door neighbor got shot. So I was afraid to leave the house. No computer, no online access, lots of pencils and paper, and I basically just escaped in my room, drawing constantly, trying to figure out how to basically make what I see in my head appear on paper, which I'm still not successful at, but it's getting closer. And I also escaped in comic books. I really enjoyed the idea of telling stories on paper with words and pictures. It was kind of magical to me. You know, you look at one image and then the next image, and there's a passage of time that intuitively takes place without any sort of expositional dialogue, like, you know, 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, anything like that. Like, your brain just can process this information, and it's a communicational tool that sort of has been around since, like, cave paintings and stuff like that. I mean, we've been telling stories through pictures forever. At a certain point, in high school, I started getting a little bit better at drawing and making comics, and I ended up going to art school, not too far from here, actually, and really started to pursue the idea of telling stories with pictures and words. And thankfully, I kind of bet my life on the idea that comics could be considered a viable form of literature that could express any sort of subject matter. It didn't have to be like this superhero shit with guys in tights and flying around punching bad guys through walls and stuff like that. I mean, I kind of like some of that stuff too, but in Japan, there are comics, manga, that explore any sort of subject matter you can imagine. There are manga for housewives who, you know, regularly go to the grocery store, and that's what the story's about. And there are manga about fishermen and all sorts of subject matter. This idea is catching on in America, and sort of in tandem with my coming of age and actually developing the ability to draw comics in a reasonable way, bookstores and academia have even, to a certain extent, accepted the idea of comics as more than just escapist fare for old dudes who live in their basement or in their mom's basement or whatnot. When I was about 21, 22 years old, I really started submitting my work to different companies to to try and get some work professionally drawing comics. It's what I've always wanted to do. And like I said, I sort of bet my life on it, so we'll see how that ends up in a couple of years. And I kind of got rejected from most of the publishers. Just the stuff that I was doing, the writing didn't catch up with the artwork. And so the stories were a little juvenile and just not very good. I sent a lot of the stuff to various cartoonists whose work I appreciated, and just for some sort of feedback, to figure out what the heck I was doing wrong, because I was trying my best, blah, blah, blah. And I started getting some interesting responses. One of those responses was from this man named Harvey Pekar of American Splendor fame. He passed away Monday, which really sucks. This is right after the American Splendor movie came out. So he was at sort of the height of his fame, and I was looking through some old American Splendor comics. I've appreciated his work pretty much my entire life, and I thought the artwork was lacking in a lot of those strips. And on one of these American Splendor comics I had, it was like a facsimile. The cover was like a facsimile Time magazine cover with a portrait of his face, not drawn, it was a photograph. And you know when you subscribe to a magazine, there's that like mechanical type that has your subscription information like planted on it? Well, it had his, like a faux version of his subscription information, like his name and address on the cover of this thing. And I was like wondering, you know, is this address still valid, or did this guy move to a castle in Beverly Hills or something like that? So just through my routine of sending my failed comic strips to various cartoonists whose work I appreciated, I started sending my strips to that address, not really expecting that it was his real address or anything like that. And I didn't hear back for a while. After months and months of just sending maybe 50, 60 packs of strips like every month, I got a phone call from Pekar. And like I said, this is after the movie came out, and I had to drag some friends to go check out this flick because, you know, it didn't get any sort of commercial distribution or anything like that, and there was no trailer on TV for this flick, so my friends really never heard of it, and it was a tough sell to get them to come hang out with me. I didn't really want to see it alone. I didn't want to be that guy in the theater. And so I brought a couple buddies along, and when Pekar called my house, he has a very, very distinct, gruff voice, and I have a buddy who could do a mean Pekar impersonation. And I thought to myself, you know, if this is you, HB, calling me, my buddy's name is HB. If this is HB calling me, that this is the most vicious prank that you can pull on me, because, you know, I wanted to draw comics so much. And I didn't believe him at first when he was on the phone, and I expressed this to a certain extent, and he's like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm what can I do? I obviously I believed him at that point, and we corresponded for like a year before any real actual work came down the pike, and eventually we started putting a project together called American Splendor, Our Movie Year, and I drew like 28 pages of this like 200 page anthology book, and it was very cool. At first I did like 4 pages, and towards the end of the project they needed a quick 25 page story done in like under a month. And when you draw comics, you know, the standard size is fairly small, but the original pages that you draw on are pretty huge, at least twice the size of the final printed page. So the work that I was doing was about 11 by 17, That's a lot of pencil mileage, as they call it. And it takes a long time to do a page of comics. So after doing the Our Movie Year stuff, he and I set to work on a long-form graphic novel called Macedonia that, you know, it received some mixed reviews because, I mean, the subject matter is a little complex and crazy. It's about the geopolitical destabilization in the Balkan region, if you're interested. And, you know, he adapted this work from a woman's thesis at University of California at Berkeley. So it's very, very heady, to say the least. Anyway, when I was working on that project, I sort of ran out of all DVD audio commentaries that I was listening to. I memorized everything. I was tired of every piece of music that I had access to. I really didn't mess around with like the peer-to-peer stuff at that time or anything like that. I really didn't know about it. Podcasting really started to become a thing. And I was, do you guys remember Tech TV? Rest in peace, Tech TV. I used to love that stuff. And then, you know, that channel went away. And then the people from Tech TV, like Leo Laporte, they started podcasting. So that's how I was introduced to that idea. And I happened upon Off the Hook. You know, it was tagged under hacking or something like that. And hacking is always something that I've romanticized in my mind. It's something I thought about, and the ideas that I had about hacking were certainly ideas that were put in my head by mass media. That movie where Ferris Bueller, you know, hacks into the government's computers at NORAD or something like that, and Zero Cool and all that bullshit. When I came across Off the Hook, I literally was hooked, and I ended up listening to the entire 20-plus year archive of that show, which if you have time available to do this, you know, because I'm sitting there drawing comics all day. The Macedonia graphic novel is like 150 pages. It took me 14 months to do, and in that 14 months, I was able to listen to all of the Off the Hook archives. And if you listen to it all, you could fast forward through the fundraiser episodes. But don't tell them I said that. There are some epic, sprawling stories that take place within that show if you listen to it in a linear fashion. And so much so that there is high drama that took place on this show. It's my belief that show should be archived like in the Smithsonian. I feel that it is so important because it really captures a moment in time where just the government was so... Not that they're any more, you know, in the know nowadays, but they were so clueless back then, and it's laughable, and you know, just you could follow the history of high technology through that show. There was like an episode where Emmanuel was like, you know, if you go to your local community college, sign up for one class, and you will have access to the internet. It's amazing, and just, you know, by his privileged position as being publisher of 2600, he obviously had access to some really interesting personalities within the community. And have you guys listened to a lot of that show? Am I telling something? You got something that you already know? What I was fascinated by the stories of like Bernie S., where, you know, he is on the show for years. And then eventually, he's like pinched by the cops, and he's not on the show. That week or whatever. And then he's on the show again, talking about his upcoming case. And then he's gone again. And then he's in jail. And then they figure out an elaborate way for Bernie to call Emmanuel's house and have the number automatically forwarded to WBAI because it's sort of against the rules for Bernie to call the radio station to be broadcast, but that's like a tricky workaround. And he was like on the show from jail, and you heard like a little beep every couple of minutes to let you know that the call is being recorded or whatever. This is a fantastic story fodder. Fiber Optic, who was on the show for you know years before the whole all the stuff from what Masters of Deception. You ever read that book? The stuff from Masters of Deception took place, and then Fiber had a court case, and he was still on the show, but it became weird to me because he wasn't allowed to really talk about anything when before he was just very happy to speak about any sort of number of things. He was kind of like, his lawyers advised him to shut his trap like about these particular issues regarding his case. And then he went to jail, and they played a show, but like the day before they took him to prison, and it was emotional. I was sitting there drawing my little comics, like dropping tears on my paper, because this poor kid is going away for a year. I mean, it was unbelievable to me. And the kid is, I mean, you know, you got to know him as much as he let you get to know him by listening to the show. And, you know, so Fiber disappeared and because he was in jail, and Emmanuel continued the show with a few other people here and there. And then the year goes by, you know, in a matter of like a week, if you're listening to 20 episodes a day or something. And, you know, they play Rude Boys Out of Jail by The Specials during the show, where they're bringing Fiber back to Manhattan after he's out of jail, and you know, after his release. And it was epic. I mean, it's giving me chills just thinking about it. And obviously the Mitnick stuff was really interesting. Another interesting thing about Off the Hook, when I was sitting drawing comics all day listening to the show, was that Emmanuel, whenever a new book on hacking, or more specifically on particular hackers like Polson, Mitnick, Fiber Optic, and those guys, Emmanuel would have access to interview these guys about the work. And so after listening to the entire archive of that, I decided to explore those books. They were all at the local library. And, you know, just upon further research and reading, I come across like work like Yipple and Tap, Frack, 2600, all sorts of material, and it's all just reading for pleasure. Certainly inspired by interesting stories that I've passively listened to while absorbing all of the Off the Hook archive, and I started to develop these. I felt that psychologically, a lot of the more sort of observed hackers that were written about, they all share fairly similar psychological traits, as far as I could tell. This might, in true life, might not really be the case, and probably isn't. But I observed a lot of similar psychological traits, and to be honest, a lot of those same mental energies, I kind of identified with as being an obsessive, crazy cartoonist who I never sleep either, and I'm constantly working in the same way these guys are constantly. Our energy is just split in different ways, and maybe if I had access to such technology when I was younger, or, you know, your formative years are a big deal. They're called your formative years for a reason. And for some reason, I just really identified with these guys, but not in a romantic way. Like, I didn't think I was like a cool fugitive or, you know, a suburban MacGyver or something like this. I just I really can't explain or articulate like how I really identified with these individuals, with their mindsets or whatnot, but I did. And I sort of had this idea, like, you know, I really want to do my own comic that I'm writing and drawing myself, because I was working with P-Car, just drawing for a couple of years. And I felt like through osmosis of reading all this information and listening to the Off the Hook show and all that sort of stuff, that in terms of being a cartoonist, this is a story I could tell that probably no other cartoonist could, because maybe most of those guys are not interested in such stuff. Maybe they don't have the fortitude to listen to a 20-plus-year archive of this radio show. Whatever the case may be, I decided to maybe take the stories, the most interesting parts of all of the hackers that I was reading about, and create a kind of pastiche narrative, compiling all of this information into one character and seeing what would happen if he lived the lives of like a young Mitnick, Polson, Fiber Optic, Bernie S., all of these people in one body. So that's sort of how WYSIWYG developed. And I set to work. I put the comic together. I sort of had an idea of the audience, and it was weird because I really didn't expect anybody to dig it. I thought it was going to be like the one volume. I kind of left it as a cliffhanger just in case people found it sort of interesting or something. And at first I did it as a what's called a mini comic. What a mini comic is basically like your Hope program book. It's just like an 8.5 by 11 piece of typing paper folded in half. That's initially what WYSIWYG was. They're called mini comics in the biz. And you know, you make them on Xeroxes and it's no big deal. It's like a dollar to make the things, and you sell it for $1.50 or something. And just something weird, like it was getting to be near Christmas time, and my girlfriend was asking, you know, what do you want for Christmas? And I couldn't think of anything, so I was just like, you know what? How about if I, you know, really plug away and put this whole book together? Would you buy me like 100 copies of this thing, you know, at some print-on-demand place? And you know, she said yes, and so Christmas comes along, and I receive this box, actually like 5 boxes of these 100 WYSIWYG Volume 1 comics, and it kind of fucked my head up, because I was like, okay, now I have a whole lot of, like, I could use this for insulation in my bedroom or something. Like, what am I going to do with this shit? I mean, I could give a couple copies away to my friends, and there's still 90 copies. I had no idea what to do with these things whatsoever. And I just sort of had the idea of maybe, you know, I listened to all these podcasts, and certainly Off the Hook and things like that, and you know, they certainly inspired the work in a big, big way. So maybe they would get a kick out of checking these things out or something. So, you know, I sent one to the 2600 PO box, and sent stuff to the different podcasts that I've enjoyed and listened to while I was working on illustrations or comics or whatever. And then what started to happen was I started to receive orders for the comics. I just emails came in, like, you know, do you have these for sale? And I think Emmanuel took WYSIWYG to like the 2600 meeting locally here, and little reviews here and there started to pop up. So just I didn't really have the knowledge or the sort of I didn't have much of an idea on how to sell this stuff online. I didn't know about like shopping carts and all this. So I just like set up a simple PayPal button on my website, and these things just started to sell. It was kind of interesting. On the BinRev forums, I kind of wanted to let those guys know, but I sort of felt like I was spamming, and I sort of let them know that I had this project that I did, and I had a whole bunch of it online, And all of these orders started to come in. And one of the people who ordered the comics was Jason Scott. He ordered the stuff. And I was blown away because I used his site for reference when I was creating the work. And I told him this. And he was like, whatever, dude, it's not gonna influence, you know, your nice words are not gonna influence my review. So I started to kind of like shit, because I'm like, oh man, if there's like, you know, 5 reviews and Jason Scott of all people says that my work is crap, then these 100 books are just going, you know, these 70 books I have are just gonna sit here forever. He reviewed it favorably and a lot more orders came in, and then this guy, Andy Bio at waxy.org, he wrote a little something, and then more orders came in. And the guys at Revision 3, like there's a show called The Totally Rad Show and Hack 5, those guys got a hold of copies and they reviewed it, and then more things sold. Boing Boing listed the comic on their site a few times, and more copies sold, and Wired Magazine did a piece. Stephen Levy, whose Hacker's book is awesome, and he's celebrating his 25th anniversary of that book, if you haven't checked it out, which I'm sure everybody did. So just like all these weird things just started happening, and I was just kind of like in awe watching like word of mouth travel, and thought it was very interesting. And I was getting rid of these comics, and what I would do is get rid of those and then maybe order another 100 and then get rid of those and just keep going and going and going. And then it sort of became obvious to me that I can continue this project, and there's enough people who are interested in it who want to see where the story's going, and people are emailing me asking me, you know, what happens next. It's kind of a tease at the end. And so, you know, I'm up to the third volume. WYSIWYG is over, it's supposed to be like a 4-book series, but it's one story, but each volume handles an individual part of the hacker's life. So like the first volume is called Freak, and it's specifically telephone stuff. And at the end he gets his first Trash 80. And the second volume is Hacker, and deals with like the early days of the BBSs, ARPANET to internet stuff, war dialing, and things like that. And then the third volume is Fugitive, which is, it's not really a romantic portrait of what it must have been like for a hacker to be on the run. I sort of did other research outside of hacking. I also have like Mitnick and Polson to figure out like what it's really like to be a fugitive, and that shit sucks. I mean, to sort of be cut off from your family, to sort of have to think of yourself as a different person. I mean, it's probably better off just going to jail or something, and you know, staying to yourself. And I've yet to put the final volume together, but you know. That's pretty much WYSIWYG. I getting talked about on Boing Boing, I got to know Cory Doctorow a little bit, and he sort of hipped me to Creative Commons. And that idea makes perfect sense to me, to just sort of increase readership, increase eyeballs. So there's a PDF of the first two volumes that you could find at my website, edpiscor.com. And you could check those out. I recently figured out ways to make like smaller files, file-sized, like CBR files, which seem to be what people like to read, the sort of the program that people like to read comics online with. So I'm gonna upload that at some point. But through the Creative Commons aspect, when Doctorow let people know that I put this PDF out there, like 30,000 of them got downloaded, like during that. Like two nights after, it's been a really cool thing. The response within the community has been very, very favorable to a large extent. There's a lot of anachronistic stuff that I did in the story that, if you're a purist or very strict on, you know, the factual aspect of everything, you'll probably be disappointed, because I wanted to switch certain things around just to make a story that was interesting to me. So I'm aware of that fact, and some people were a little weirded out by it. Last year I was asked to speak at Nauticon, which was my first hacking conference I've ever been to or anything like that, and I was terrified because just reading people's comments, not about my work per se, online, but just in general, like flame wars that would happen, and I was kind of freaked out because these people obviously, you know, speak their mind, and when they saw me face to face, they were just going to let me have it or something if they didn't agree with something, and I haven't found that was the case at all. Everybody seems very positive. The one negative comment I got personally was in the elevator at Nauticon. I saw Bernie S. get on the elevator, and my little name tag, you know, it had my name on it, and I recognized that it was Bernie S. because I saw him in Freedom Downtime, and I referenced him in one panel in the first WYSIWYG book, and he saw me, and he said, "Piscor, you're the guy that did that comic. I have a bone to pick with you," and I got freaked out. In the Wired article, they showed the one panel that Bernie was referenced, and it's there's a strip where it's called The Misadventures of Steve and Steve that I put in there, and it's Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, but I don't include their names, but I have them dressed up as I'll show panels from that in a minute. I have them dressed up in their like Alice in Wonderland outfits because they worked at like a local mall. As you know, like the Mad Hatter and the White Rabbit, and so Steve Jobs is on this payphone, and you know they used to sell blue boxes, and Jobs is talking to Wozniak like, "Yeah, I have this guy Bernie in Philadelphia. He wants to buy three of these boxes from us." So Bernie catches me in the elevator, and he's like, "You make me seem so lame that I have to buy these things. I made these things before they knew what blue boxes were." And I was like mortified because I listened to this guy, I sort of mythologized him in a big way, and the section of the story that I was in really didn't, like, I wasn't able to squeeze in any cool Bernie S. references at that point. But, you know, that certainly is going to change when the character's in jail with some of the bullshit he went through. But I wanted to give at least a little nod to him in that first book. And that's the only place I could think to, like, squeeze it in. And I meant it with affection and with positive vibes. And I sort of let him know this. And I think he saw how bummed out I was when he said that to me. And And I'll have you know, at this last Nauticon, he and I shared a bed. you know, we became very friendly after that. I kind of dug myself a hole. How are we doing on time? Wow, I actually spoke for 38 minutes. This isn't typical for me, by the way. I'm very, very shy. And I wasn't expecting to be able to sort of filibuster this long. Does anybody have any questions or anything like that about this work or whatever?
Yeah, thanks for covering the background and stuff like that. You mentioned that you're doing Bone Floor. One thing, you talked about why you decided to go with kind of fictionalizing the whole story, which that's great. But I'm wondering, are you going to do, considering works that would be, where's that microphone?
I was asking about the future work that he might be doing, and about how the WYSIWYG series was fictionalized based on the 2600, which is all great. But are you considering doing any more nonfiction type stuff, or things either based on, you know, the true life stories, or even some of the more technical type hacking stuff? Because I think you'd be good at that.
Thanks a lot. That's a good question because, to be honest, initially, WYSIWYG is a product of me not being able to get in touch with the actual hackers to do. I was very interested in doing like a Bernie S. biography because nothing sort of exists about him in his particular situation, and he went through some bullcrap. You know, like, I'm not sure if everybody knows, but when he was in prison, he got the living shit beat out of him, and he's got, like, a bionic arm now and, like, a wired jaw, and he's got completely screwed up, and I really wanted to do a biography, a nonfiction biography about him. But the only way that I would ever do a piece of nonfiction is if I can work and collaborate with the actual person, because I don't want to participate in creating something that's like that takedown movie that just is sort of skewed and the opinion of one person and, you know, full of inaccuracy. So the reason why I did do this fictional story is I almost feel like my comic is what that takedown flick should have been, in as much as, you know, they used Mitnick's real name, and, you know, Skeet Ulrich played him, and it really romanticized a lot of stuff. And I think the guy was still in jail when the flick was being made, and they had these foredrawn conclusions about how his situation was going to end up, and that just seemed fucking crazy. That seemed like so irresponsible and evil. And they're in the WYSIWYG books, like at the end, for the comic crowd, actually, I sort of describe a lot of, I sort of have an annotated section in the back that lets people know sort of like some of the stuff I snuck in there. And I even feel bad about including people's names like Kevin Poulsen with certain situations that are kind of popular, but like, but I didn't for myself hear from his mouth that it was factual. And I feel like now, sort of looking back on it, I feel pretty awful about that. And I'm going to take that stuff out whenever I put the entire story together or whatever. I would love to do a piece of nonfiction, but maybe with WYSIWYG out there, that would give me some sort of legitimacy with the actual hackers whose stories I'm interested in, and maybe they would be interested in working with me. And if so, I would be more than happy to. But you know, I just don't want to. I have such a positive feeling from researching and finding stuff out about these hackers that I don't want to do anything negative or irresponsible with these people, or, you know, with these people's lives, essentially, and perpetrate myths or anything like that. Another weird thing that I really didn't intend on is having like two different audiences with WYSIWYG. Like, I really didn't think, because I just imagine that people who read comics are just people who, it's like this like niche, and that's it, and other people really can't be introduced to comics because maybe it weirds them out. And it's certainly, when I go into a comic shop and I see like these, like a big red Hulk and like with these ripped muscles and these chicks with huge boobs and waists like this and big, it's like, it's too much. It's like sensory overload. And I could see why people are turned off by this stuff. But within the community, there is a audience that has developed from these comics, which I'm very proud of. And a lot of people are being introduced to comics for the first time through WYSIWYG, which I feel a huge responsibility for, because there are a lot of cartoonists whose work I hate. And the reason why I have such vile feelings towards them is because their comic might be the first comic that somebody reads, and it's shit. And I don't want that to be somebody's experience. I mean, this is like my livelihood, and I don't want your first experience to be reading something crappy. But what has developed with these two different audiences that the book has, it's almost like a contrived scheme that I developed, because within the comics crowd, they find that the story is fascinating, interesting, and to a certain extent, I mean, I have the annotations in the back describing like the real life events or technological things that I sort of stole from. And but they think that it's like a really cool, compelling story. And with the hacking crowd, the technology crowd, they're interested in the way the story's told And I just stole storytelling techniques from my favorite cartoonists. So, like, in, on both, like, niche audiences that I have, people typically think I'm pretty cool when all I'm doing is taking info and like, stuff I learned from a whole bunch of other people. So basically, I'm here to tell you that I'm not original at all. But if you want to check out my comics, I'm going to be downstairs at the mezzanine. Come, feel free to take a look and grab a sticker and stick it someplace. I'm going to be serializing the work. I decided to go back and rewrite a lot of the stuff just to tighten things up. I feel like as a kid, when you're learning to draw, there is an exponential growth that happens at a certain point where you are drawing stick figures, and then you could draw passable stuff that looks like more structured and awesome, and that happens in a very fast span. And while writing the WYSIWYG comics, I feel like I had that exponential growth in terms of writing from the first volume to the third volume that I felt like I had to go back and tighten things up so that it kind of like matches the whole way through. I'm not saying I'm a great writer or anything, by the way, but it's better. It's going to be better than what I initially had, and I'm going to be serializing that stuff at WYSIWYGcomics.com. I'm putting up like two pages. Putting up like 2 pages a week of the story, and you know, it'll take like maybe a year and a half or something for the whole thing to appear online. But yeah, feel free if you come hang out if you want to check out my comics or whatever. Does anybody have any other questions or comments or anything like that? If you do, please step up to the mic. Do you have a question, sir?
Yes.
Cool. Here's the mic.
Thank you. My question is more technical. How do you, what techniques do you use for drawing? And how long does it take? Do you use any templates, or what kind of technique do you use? And how long does it take you to make this, let's say, one panel?
Okay. Here, let me put this back. Each page of WYSIWYG is structured as like a four-panel page, kind of like the same structure as the comic strips that you see in the newspaper. And those are originally like 5-inch by 5-inch squares, each individually. It takes me like a whole day to put together a page of those comics. The writing sort of takes me forever. It's just, there's so much thinking that goes behind the scenes that like before I hit the final page with what I want to do, half the day has already passed. So then I draw it in with like a non-repro blue colored pencil, because when you apply ink over top of that and you scan it, you don't see the pencil lines, and that will save me like maybe a year's worth of time eventually of erasing. Each book took like probably close to a year to come to fruition, because this is like my moonlighting thing. I did the American Splendor stuff and other comics with Harvey during the day. I pieced together an income in all weird sort of ways, like by doing speaking things and doing illustration work in magazines and stuff like that. What's that?
6 minutes.
Oh, okay. By doing illustration, so I would have to do that stuff to sort of live. And when normal people are spending time with their loved ones and or watching television or enjoying life, then I like go to the basement and start working on my WYSIWYG comic, because that brings me the same sort of pleasure that other people get going fishing or watching football or crap like that. So I would love to work on it full time, but it's just not a possibility. So as it stands, like each volume has taken basically a year to come out. Any other questions? You want to step up to the mic?
I was just curious about the response from the kind of traditional comic book scene.
A lot of people, like I said, they find the story pretty really interesting, and it's sort of the people who have decided to read it. It really opened up their mind to the idea of what a hacker is. Another thing I wanted to get across in the work is sort of doing my best not to misrepresent what it means to be a hacker. I sort of was imbued with this idea by the words of Emmanuel Goldstein throughout that entire archive of Off the Hook, where the term hacker started to mean basically criminal, and that that just seemed extremely wrong, and the word has deep roots that are very positive. So the response has been pretty cool. Publishers were interested in the work, comics publishers, and some of them still are, and they seem to like where things are going, so maybe I'll have one of these guys distributed, because I feel like I've done everything I could in terms of getting it out there that I could do on my own, but maybe, I don't know, I'm sort of playing around with that idea. But initially, when I had this idea, because publishers, a few guys were interested in publishing my work, and I described WYSIWYG and what I wanted it to be, and they would say stuff like, there sure are a lot of telephone conversations in that phone freak section of the book. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? And these characters sure are spending a lot of time in front of a computer console. And, I certainly did not want to do one of these, the kid types away at a keyboard and a satellite falls out of the sky, or hyper-real bullshit, fictional pieces of garbage. Like, that is not what I'm interested in. So, but as they see sort of the audience that is growing, that I'm sort of cultivating, I feel so gross speaking this way too, by the way. It's all happening by accident. The audience is sort of developing, like the publishers are sort of showing up and are like becoming more acceptable to the idea of putting this out. Like, there are people out there who would like to see this thing in like a nice handsome volume, as opposed to my like print on demand, flimsy copies or whatever. So the response has been pretty cool. And I think that might be it. So I'm gonna go run down to the mezzanine. If you guys wanna come hang out throughout the day, I'm gonna be there all day. Thanks for lending me your ears. I appreciate it a lot. And thanks a lot for that little clapping ovation for my pal Harv, who passed away, man. I really appreciate that. I know he would too. Oh, okay. Yeah, I do. I was kind of like...